Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today the Quarter-Century Wireless Association Journal for the winter of 2011-2012. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System in cooperation with the QCWA. It's for the intentions and listening pleasure of the members of those organizations only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The Handy Ham website is www.handyham.org. The QCWA Journal is published four times a year, that's quarterly, by the Quarter-Century Wireless Association, Incorporated. Membership in QCWA, including a subscription to the journal, is available to individuals who qualify in the United States and its possessions at the following rates: $25 for 1 year, $40 for 2 years, $55 for 3 years, and $500 for life. For Canadian and farm membership rates, please contact the business office. The business office is located at QCWA Incorporated, P.O. Box 3247, Framingham, Massachusetts, zip code 01705. Their voice phone number is area 508-405-1930. If you would like to fax them, it's area 508-405-1965. And you can email to qcwagm@rcn.com. The editor-designer is Douglas Walbridge. He can be located at that address. The webmaster, Bob Roski, amateur call N0UF. Bob lives in Hutchinson, Minnesota. Now, here's a quick rundown of the QCWA officers and the board of directors. President Bob Roski, N0UF. Vice President Ken Olke, VE6AFO. Secretary Vic Culver, W4VIC. Treasurer Frank Harris, WA4PAM. And the directors, Leroy Baldwin, Val Irwin, Gary Harrison, Larry McCalvey, Ken Simpson, Ernie Skip Svensson, and the President Emeritus, Harry J. Daniels, amateur call W2HD. The publication editor is Douglas Walbridge at the Framingham, Massachusetts address. Scholarship Chairman is Leland Smith, Jr., W4YE. We'll be talking quite a bit about the scholarships that have just been awarded. For those of you who use and have internet capabilities, the website for the QCWA is www.qcwa.org. The officers, directors, and headquarters staff wish our members and their families a happy holiday and the very best wishes for the new year of 2011. We'll begin with a report from the President, Bob Broski, N0UF. The winter of 2011. The 2011 convention in Warwick, Rhode Island is history. The convention committee did a great job getting everything lined up. It's obvious the economy is still wracking havoc, but attendance was down. Minutes of the annual members' meeting can be found elsewhere in this issue of the journal. The 2012 convention is scheduled for Reno, Nevada. We are looking for a chapter or chapters to step up and apply to host our convention in 2013. You should start planning very soon. It takes longer than you think, and time really does fly. Our hardworking secretary, Walt Sapina, N3WS, has stepped down. His better half, Ora Lee, was having some problems, but I'm happy to report she is doing better. Vic Culver, W4VIC, was appointed to fill the remainder of Walt's term. Vic was running unopposed in the next election. Many of you know Vic as the chairman of the 2008 convention. He also puts out a weekly QCWA newsletter for the state of Virginia in English and Spanish. Rue Stutville, Jr., W4RUE, has stepped up to assume the position of audio recording coordinator, which was vacated when Vic became our secretary. If your chapter has a blind member, or you know a blind member that isn't involved in the program of receiving audio material, please send their information to Rue via his CBA. We need to come up with another name, as we no longer use cassette tapes. Rue was also instrumental in establishing our presence on Twitter. 5 presidential awards were announced and in 2 cases presented in Warwick, Rhode Island. Ron Fish, KX1W, 4, work on the Publication Standing Committee. Roger Volk, K0GOB, for work on the Financial Standing Committee. Howard Cunningham, WD5DBC, 4, work on the Administration Standing Committee, the Chapter Relations Standing Committee, and for providing the web hosting service for www.qcwa.org. Bob Boos, W2OD, for being the logging checker for our QSO parties. Vic Culver, W4VIC, for work on the Chapter Relations Standing Committee, the Publication Standing Committee, and for being the audio recording coordinator. The board also approved awarding the John DeBlasi Award to Walt Sapina and 3WS for his service to QCWA as secretary. It was also my pleasure to present the QCWA Roll of Honor Award to K1IGD, Chuck Walbridge, at the Saturday Night Convention Banquet. As I said at the banquet, the award is for Chuck and his number one helper, Janet. A big thanks to both of you. I had the honor of attending the 100th birthday party of Ben Miller, W0DKL, in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, on October 22nd. I had presented Ben with his 80-year Golden Anniversary Award in 2008. 73DE and 0UF OP, Bob Roski, President, QCWA. The Quarter Century Wilds Association was founded December 5, 1947, as a non-commercial association of radio amateurs organized for the promotion of interest in amateur radio communication and experimentation for the establishment and advancement of the radio art and of the public welfare. QCWA is an incorporated association without capital stock, chartered under the laws of the state of New York, and is a tax-exempt 501c3 organization under the Internal Revenue Code of 1986. Its affairs are governed by a president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, and a board of directors whose voting members are elected every 2 years by the general membership. In order to qualify for membership in QCWA, one must have demonstrable proof of having been first licensed as an amateur radio operator at least 25 years prior to application for membership and must be currently licensed. Membership inquiries and general correspondence should be addressed to the business office at P.O. Box 3247, Framingham, Massachusetts, zip code 01705. Or the phone numbers and fax numbers and email that was given to you a few moments ago. The General Manager's Report by Chuck Walbridge, K1IGD. Again, the winter of 2011. QCWA and the economy. QCWA, like the rest of you, is experiencing the impact of the current economic conditions in the United States and around the world. Reports from our financial advisors are cautious, but all indicate the basics of the U.S. economy are sound. We are, however, living in a world environment, and what happens in the world does impact QCWA as well as each of us. With these conditions in mind, as GM, I will be taking some action to reduce the office expenses with the least impact on continuing to provide to the members the support and services you have received in the past. One of the first changes you will notice is that the membership card will no longer have a perforated member card, but an indication where you can trim the card if you wish to place it in your wallet. To have the cards perforated, is an extra step in the printing process. Eliminating this will save several hundred dollars in printing costs and allow access to a broader selection of vendors. These cards will be phased in after the existing stock is depleted. The Gold Plastic Life member card will also be replaced. Over time, the companies producing these cards do not wish to deal with the small volume of cards QCWA needs. They're all looking to produce a large quantity of special cards. These cards will be replaced with a special, unique printed membership card for life members. Cost of QCWA member supplies for years have included the postage for U.S., Canada, and international mailing. These mailing costs have risen over the years, and it is now necessary to make some adjustments in those costs. Postage for U.S. mailing, U.S. zip codes, will continue to be included in the price. An additional fee for non-U.S. zip codes will be added effective for orders after January 1, 2012. The items under consideration are caps, shirts, belt buckles, and mouse pads. Badges and QSL cards already have added shipping costs identified, and the vendor for wood plaques includes those costs when the item is quoted after the order is placed. I'll be working with the Board of Directors to assess other possible cost savings as well as programs to provide additional current income as well as long-term investment and growth programs. As these ideas and plans become firm, information will be posted on the web page and email notices will be distributed via the QCWA email reflectors. The QCWA Board of Directors established a program called the QCWA Endowment Fund in the year 1999. This fund was established to provide a source of funds independent of dues for long-term programs, operating expenses, or other purposes as defined by the Board of Directors. Frank Harris, Treasurer, has provided some ideas of how members may make contributions to that fund. If interested in any of these, you should consult with your attorney, CPA, or financial advisor. There'll be more information about this on page 13. Jan and I send greetings and best wishes to everyone as we celebrate the upcoming holiday seasons. 73, Chuck and Jan. The following commentary should be very, very interesting to all of the QCWA members. Board of Directors Meeting Summary and Members General Meeting Summary, September 8, 2011. Board of Directors Meeting Summary, September 8, 2011. President Roski called the Board of Directors to order at 0800 on September 8, 2011. Present were Vice President Olke, Acting Secretary Culver, Treasurer Harris, Directors Mr. Baldwin, Mr. Irwin, Mr. Harrison, Mr. Smith, Mr. Swenson, and General Manager Walbridge. Not present, Directors Mr. Hirsch, Mr. McCalvey, and Mr. Simpson. President Roski welcomed the board to the convention and introduced the slate of candidates for office as proposed by the nominations committee. President Roski called for a moment of silence to reflect upon our silent keys. President Roski asked for approval of the agenda, and the agenda was adopted. President Roski then asked for a motion from the board, and Mr. Harrison moved to appoint Mr. Culver, acting secretary, to the position of secretary, filling that position following the resignation of Secretary Subpoena. The motion was seconded by Mr. Irwin, and the motion passed. Mr. Culver assumed the position of secretary. President Roski introduced a candidate for director of the 2012 election, Stephen Licht, L-I-C-H-T, amateur call WF2S, Whiskey Foxtrot 2 Sierra, who was attending the BOD meeting as an invited observer. QCWA officers reported to the board. Vice President Olke, chairman of the search committee, reported on progress to secure candidates for general manager and journal editor position. Secretary Culver reported on Board of Director motions passed since the last general members meeting in Dayton, including recognition of Leo Meyerson, call W0GFQ, on his 100th birthday, extension of the contract for retiring QCWA Journal editor D. Wallbridge, adoption of the 2011 operating budget proposal, approval of honorary member status for Ruth Cohen, approval of a dues increase effective July 1, 2012, approval for Chapter 162 to host a QCWA cruise in 2013, approved a motion to award QCWA General Manager Chuck Wallbridge, K1IGD, the Roll of Honor Award, and approved a resolution thanking 2011 convention host Svensson and Muckle and host chapters Yankee Chapter 112, Pine Tree Chapter 134, Twin States Chapter 146, Nutmeg Chapter 149, Pioneer Chapter 183, and all committee members, spouses, and assistants for an enjoyable convention. Treasurer Harris reported on the overall financial health of the organization, noting that the endowment fund has done well, but that we need to review our overall expenses. It was noted specifically that scholarships awarded must be funded from interest paid by the scholarship fund, that all expenses for the scholarship fund be taken from fund proceeds, and that the principal must not be spent. General Manager Wallbridge indicated that all office routines are functioning normally. New items obtained for resale to members include new QSL cards and new belt buckles. Office software has been updated. General Manager Wallbridge indicated current membership at something around 7,000, exact numbers fluctuating from time to time, including approximately 6,000 U.S. members, 250 Canadian members, and the remainder from various DX countries. The current HQ office contract ends March 31, 2012. Discussions were led by chairpersons of the standing committees. Items discussed included a recommendation for review of the QCWA Journal editorial policy. A small increase in QCWA QSO party participation was noted. Planning for the 2012 convention in Reno, Nevada is underway with several innovative concepts being explored. A PowerPoint presentation is nearing completion that will assist local chapters in their recruitment efforts. A caution was announced that H.R. 607, the Broadband for First Responders Act of 2011, still poses a threat to amateur radio 70-centimeter band, but that S.B. 1040, the Senate bill, provides protection. QCWA members are urged to support S.B. 1040. The importance of flying the flag, showing the QCWA banner at recruiting, information, tables, and booths at hamfests and other gatherings was emphasized as important in generating growth of the organization. A major topic of discussion was the need for oversight of organization expenses, making content of the QCWA Journal relevant and timely to members was discussed, with recommendations for increased use of the QCWA reflector by members for short-term announcements. Increased contact with the membership is a goal of the Board of Directors, and reflector usage is encouraged. Coordination between QCWA and the FAR scholarship program is being examined, with the desire for QCWA to be more formally identified with QCWA scholarship recipients. After a break for lunch, 12 p.m. to 1:10 p.m., the Board of Directors was again called to order by President Roski. New business included wide-ranging discussion concerning cost reductions and savings for the organization. Two motions were passed, one to approve solicitation of gift contributions, and the second to affect cost savings of the Board of Director functions at conventions. Member benefits were discussed, with a proposal to include identity theft protection as a member benefit taken under consideration. President Roski named a teller committee for the 2012 election. Herb Lacey, W3HL team leader, with WB4DCM, W4CHX, and K4HF as team members. President Roski proposed Walt Sopina and 3WS for the John DeBlacy Award, and the nomination was enthusiastically accepted without objection. The meeting was adjourned at 3:30 p.m. with Board of Director members assembling for the traditional Board of Director photograph. Submitted by Vic Culver, W4VIC, Secretary, QCWA, Incorporated. The following commentary is the Members' General Meeting Summary for September 8, 2011. President Roeske called the meeting to order at 09:30 a.m., and after a moment of silence honoring QCWA Silent Keys and those who lost life in the September 11, 2001 attacks, welcomed members to the convention with an overview of events. Vice President Oki commented on the search committee to find a replacement for retiring General Manager Walbridge. Contract adjustments are being made to permit an orderly transfer of responsibilities. A concern was expressed regarding membership retention and growth. President Roeske reported on the financial status of the organization, indicating that several initiatives are being considered to secure the financial security of the organization. Secretary Culver reported on his impression of his first Board of Director meeting, saying that the members could rest assured that the organization enjoys a hard-working board committed to serious analysis of issues and intend to improve the status of the organization. Director Irvin reported on the adverse impact of House Bill HB 607 on the 70-centimeter amateur band and recommended support of Senate Bill SB 1040 as a substitute bill that would better achieve the objectives of the Broadband for First Responders Initiative. Support of Senate Bill 1040 was recommended. Director Irvin, reporting for Director Simpson, spoke about the importance of QCWA presence at hamfests and other meetings to the overall benefit of QCWA. Director Harrison reported briefly on the activities of the Administration Standing Committee, indicating significant progress toward filling the general manager position. Long-term problems facing the organizations are being reviewed for possible recommended actions. Director Baldwin gave a brief history of the QCWA Journal, indicating the significant improvements over the years. Mr. Baldwin reported on the development of the taping program for visually handicapped, developed with the good offices of the HandyHam program. Webmaster and President Roeske reported on a development and updating of the QCWA website and of the QCWA reflector as a means of rapid dissemination of QCWA information. George Roach, coordinator of the QCWA CUSO party activity, encouraged the need for stronger support for this activity. General Manager Walbridge reported on the status of the headquarters office. Computers have been updated, and all processes are working well. Mr. Walbridge reported on the availability of new design QCWA QSL cards and the availability of high-quality belt buckles in silver and brass tone colors. Mr. Walbridge thanked all for support of the headquarters office, especially for his wife Jan, the office manager. He remembered longtime friends and those who have gone before in his longtime association with QCWA. Chuck received a standing ovation from those assembled, and when joined by Jan, both were affectionately applauded. President Roeske then thanked the convention committee, especially co-chairs Skip Svensson and Ray Meckel, and all the committee members and volunteers who made the convention a success. QCWA presidential awards were made to the following: Bob Boos, W2OD, for his contribution for QCWA CUSO Party Scoring and Awards. Vic Culver, W4VIC, for his contribution to the Chapter Relations Committee, the Publication Standing Committee, and for his contribution as tape coordinator. Howard Cunningham, W5DBC, for contributions to the Publications Committee and website hosting. Ron Fish, KX1W, for his contributions to the Publications Committee as journal proofreader. Roger Volk, K0GOB, for his contributions to the QCWA Finance Committee. The meeting was adjourned at 10:30 a.m. Submitted by Vic Culver, W4VIC, Secretary, QCWA, Incorporated. What follows next is the QCWA Scholarship Award Winners list of presentations. We begin with Amateur Call KC0YLD, Alex Brich, B-R-E-C-H. Alex is 22 years old and a senior at the South Dakota School of Mines, majoring in computer engineering. Alex holds an extra class license and is a member of the ARRL. He is also a volunteer examiner and president of the South Dakota School of Mines Amateur Radio Club. Alex was recommended for the Chichester Scholarship by Gary Peterson, K0CX, for the Black Hills ARC, an ARRL-affiliated club. Don called W6EEN and Phyllis Doughty Family Scholarship. Amateur called KC2NSA, Stephanie Schaefer. Stephanie Schaefer is a 22-year-old who will be enrolled in the master's program in special education at the University of Scranton in the fall. She graduated from Marywood University in 2010 with a degree in elementary education, mathematics, and music, and is completing a certificate in teaching English to speakers of other languages at Drexel University. She holds a general class license and is active on HF single sideband and enjoys meeting new people over the air and emergency communications. She won a QCWA scholarship in the year 2010. She is recommended for the QCWA scholarship by William Thompson, W2MTA. The scholarships, QCWA Randall, $1,000, and Old Timers, $1,000. Amateur call N4NJJ, William Freeman. This winner is 18 and holds a general class license. He will be a freshman at George Mason University, planning to major in government and international politics with a minor in music. He will look to pursue a career in teaching and is also considering law school. He is active on VHF, UHF, FM, and ATV. He is the PIO and newsletter editor for the Lancaster ARC and is net control for the weekly net sponsored by the Tonawandas Amateur Radio Association. He receives a QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KC2PMW, Andrew Furlong. Andrew is 17 and will be a freshman at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. He plans to major in electrical engineering with an eye toward a career in circuit design. Andrew holds an extra class license and is active on HF single sideband and digital modes and VHF UHF FM. He is a member of the Phi Mont Mobile Radio Club. His father, John, is amateur call KC2UT. He's receiving the Ralph Hasslinger, the W2CVF, Charter Member Scholarship. Amateur call K1RJG, Robert Giuliani. Robert is a junior majoring in health studies at the University of Hartford, where he has been on the dean's list every semester of his college career. He is a general class licensee and a member of the Stratford Amateur Radio Club, where he participates in field day. Robert is an Eagle Scout and a member of the University of Hartford's track and cross-country teams. Robert is recommended by QCWA member number 6761, Betsy Doan, call K1EIC. He receives QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KG6ECE, Frederick Mayer. Frederick is 19, lives in Soquel, California, and plans to enter UC Berkeley in the fall. Having gained a first-hand knowledge of practical electronics in the course of building homebrew radio projects, Frederick plans to major in electrical engineering and computer science. He holds a general class license and is active on all bands and modes, using the family ham shack. His mother, father, and sister are all hams. He's receiving the Leo Morrison W0GFQ Family Living Scholarship. Amateur call KC9SNY, Matthew Plousgrove. Matthew is 17 and a recent graduate of Grays Lake Central High School. He will be attending the University of Illinois in the fall, majoring in electrical engineering. He holds a technician class amateur radio license from the FCC, which relates to his interest in technology and electronics, receiving a QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KI6KYP, Andrew Renwick. Andrew is 18 and a student at the University of California, Davis, majoring in aerospace and mechanical engineering. He holds a general class amateur radio license from the FCC. His interest in amateur radio is broad, and he especially enjoys long-distance DX communications. He is also a California Regents Scholar. He's receiving a QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KC2LR, Lauren Rice. Lauren is 19 years old and a junior at Cornell, majoring in biological sciences with a minor in electrical engineering. Lauren holds an extra class license, participates in public service events and contests, and enjoys RTTY. Lauren was recommended for the QCWA scholarship by James Mosley, W2BCH, and receives the Jacobson Keller, that's W3OUG and W4ZG, family scholarship. Amateur call KB1LQD, Brenton Salmi. Brenton is 21 and currently a student at the Rochester Institute of Technology, where he is majoring in electrical engineering. He holds a general class amateur radio license from the FCC. He has a broad interest in amateur radio, including digital communications. He is also an avid mountain cyclist and a drummer. He's receiving a QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KB1LQC, Bryce Salmi. Bryce is 21. And holds an amateur extra class license. He is a senior at the Rochester Institute of Technology, RIT, majoring in electrical engineering with intent to pursue a career in RF design. Bryce is vice president of the RIT Radio Club and is a member of the Police Amateur Radio Team in Westford, Massachusetts. Bryce and his twin brother, Brenton, KB1LQD, are the co-founders of the College Amateur Radio Club Association. He is active on all modes, on HF, VHF, and UHF. Bryce is an avid mountain biker and is a musician. He also receives a Quarter Century Wireless Association Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KJ4PLS, James Schwalbel. James is 19 and a student at Georgia Institute of Technology, majoring in biomedical engineering and biochemistry. He holds a general class amateur radio license from the FCC, and he enjoys contesting as well as the technical aspects of amateur radio. The receiver of a QCWA Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KC0QIO, Jack Short. Jack is 24. And a third-year student at the University of Missouri School of Medicine. Jack holds a technician class license, enjoys field day, and has been active with several Kansas City area clubs. Jack is recommended by QCWA member number 22695, Dale Huffington, AE0S. He receives the Alfred Burke W3VR Memorial Scholarship. Amateur call KC8IOY, Stephen Simpson. Stephen is 21 years old from Ocala, Florida, and a graduate student at the University of Florida, Gainesville, majoring in electrical and computer engineering. Stephen holds an extra class license and enjoys digital modes and satellite communications. He receives the Travis Baird W9VQD Memorial Scholarship. A very hearty congratulations to all of these winners for the QCWA Scholarship Award program in this past year. The Board of Directors invites you to join the QCWA Legacy Society. Membership in the Legacy Society requires a statement of intent to provide a gift to the QCWA Endowment Fund. There are a number of ways in which you can make a bequest, including the following techniques. Remember that QCWA and its board of directors cannot render legal or tax advice. Please consult your attorney, CPA, or financial advisor. Bequest of cash or property. An outright bequest of cash or property, such as shares of stock or a piece of real estate, would transfer the property at your death. A provision in your will might read as follows, quoting, I bequeath to the QCWA General Manager and Board of Directors of QCWA the following property. There's a space for that intention. To be used for general purposes, close quote. Residuary bequest. By using this technique, you can leave all or a percentage of remainder of your estate after you have provided for your family and other specific beneficiaries, after taxes and expenses have been paid. A provision in your will might read as follows, quoting, I bequeath all, in parentheses, or, leaving it blank for your determination, percentage, of my residuary estate to the General Manager and Board of Directors of QCWA, close quote. Contingent bequest. QCWA can also be included as a beneficiary if your named beneficiaries, such as family and loved ones, predecease you. A provision in your will might read as follows, quoting, I bequeath to my son, John Doe, the sum of blank, and in the event he shall predecease me, I direct this sum to be paid to the QCWA General Manager and Board of Directors of QCWA. Close quote. Other types of gifts. Life insurance. You can name QCWA as the beneficiary, in whole or in part, of an existing life insurance policy. Retirement plans. Most tax-deferred retirement plans, such as a 401k or an IRA, permit you to name an organization such as QCWA as the beneficiary or all or part of the total amount. Charitable annuities or remainder trusts. Gifts can also be made that will provide income to the donor for life, followed by a gift to QCWA. Life estate gifts. Property can be transferred to QCWA in such a way that the donor retains the right to use the property or the income for life. Restricted bequests. Unrestricted gifts are the most flexible and useful way to provide for QCWA because the Board of Directors can use the funds to meet whatever need is most urgent at the time the gift is received. A restricted bequest designates a specific fund at QCWA, such as the endowment or operating fund. We urge you to consult the GM QCWA before including such a gift in order to make sure the language is flexible enough to allow for the possibility that the program may be discontinued or priorities may change. The following provision would be useful to accommodate such contingencies. Quoting, if any time, at the discretion of the Board of Directors of QCWA, this bequest shall no longer be considered necessary or appropriate for the stated purpose, the Board of Directors of QCWA shall have the authority to designate its use for another purpose that, to the extent possible, closely honors its original intent. Close quote. We hope you will consider becoming a member of the QCWA Legacy Society. This commentary is signed Frank C. Harris, Sr. Call WA4PAM, Treasurer and Member of Finance Committee. Here's the commentary relative to the QCWA 2012 Reno, Nevada Convention to be held September 24 through 27, the year, of course, 2012. The location. The convention will be held at Harris, Reno. The newly redecorated rooms include free Wi-Fi. The rooms are located in West Tower and provide easy access to the meeting rooms, dining facilities, of which there are several, and an excellent spa. The rate for the room is $59 U.S. per night, single or double occupancy. Additional coupons and discounts will be available with each room reservation. Friends or relatives that want to join us during this period may enjoy the same rate and amenities at the same rate as the registered convention guests. Hotel reservations will be made separately. The hotel phone number and QCWA discount code will be provided. With regard to transportation, the hotel is located one block away from the Amtrak train station. Harrah's has a shuttle service that provides free transportation to and from the Reno Tahoe International Airport. That's code RNO. The hotel has a large parking complex that provides free parking, as do most of the hotels in the area for guests and non-guests. The following presentations are planned. We have several presentations and activities planned for Tuesday and Wednesday during the convention. A listing of the program will be available in the spring. It has been a long time since QCWA has hosted a convention on the West Coast. This year's upcoming convention will be the first in 14 years. Every effort is being made to make this a memorable convention. Reno was chosen for its proximity to California, which contains a large amateur radio population, but also for the diversity of activities in the Reno area. In addition to our regular convention presentations and activities, we have a diverse variety of activities in the area. When people think of Reno or Las Vegas, the first thought that comes to mind is gambling. The truth is that there is no gambling in Reno. It's gaming. The payout is regulated by the State Gaming Commission. It's gambling when you are taking a chance. In the Reno area, you are not taking a chance. There are shows, dining, scenery, shops, sports, museums, and various adventures to enjoy in the immediate area. Gaming is a small activity compared to all that is available in the Reno Sparks area. Come be a part of the convention. We are still accepting presentation suggestions and material. If you have a presentation to share, let us know, and we can include it in our growing list of presentations. We have several meeting rooms available with full audiovisual support. We will list the program information and events in the QCWA Journal and in our newsletters. We are extending our welcome to this convention to other related organizations outside of QCWA. The year 2012 will be for all serious amateur radio operators to participate in our convention and, if eligible, to join our organization. As a sponsor or participant, you are supporting and getting your name out to these diverse individuals worldwide. So whether young or old, there is something for everyone. Too much to put into a few pages. We will be publishing an email newsletter and updating our websites with the latest information. Each issue will contain photos and list details on various tours, shows, activities, and events in the Reno, Tahoe area. If you'd like to subscribe to the email notification about the convention, send it to the following in uppercase, letters only, ADNYP@att.net. Updates and additional information is available on the following QCWA websites, www.qcwa.org and www.qsl.net/QCWA-1. Well, it's time now to look at the chapter reports. It's very important that the secretaries of each club spread out through the United States and Canada and elsewhere file those reports on a timely basis for publication in the quarterly journals so that their chapter, your chapter, that has a sight or print-impaired individual who wishes to hear the reporting of the secretary for that chapter has to be able to get it into the publication. I'll begin with Chapter 8, Upper Midwest, Minnesota. We just enjoyed our first meeting at the new digs. After the Fort Snelling Club abruptly closed last spring, we tried two other venues and settled on the Eagles Eyrie, number 34, at 2507 East 25th Street, Minneapolis, as the best choice. They are centrally located, have a new audio-video system in the meeting room, and serve a great lunch. We have 13 members in attendance to watch an excellent presentation covering some of the ham-related videos that are on the web. It was presented by Ralph Bierbaum and Zero AWN. We meet on the third Saturday every other month from September through May. Check our website for the location, date, and time of our holiday party. Our May meeting is usually shifted because of Dayton. Our net meets Saturday morning at 3.908 megahertz at 0800 Central Time. Baldy, W0OFY, is the NCS. Check the Chapter 8 webpage for information and pictures. That's http://www.qcwa.org/chapter008. .htm. Silent Key, Jim Stadolka, W0TIV, became a Silent Key on July 31st. Jim, Q number 5806, was the ninth person in Minnesota to have a ham radio license. He was active on all bands and was also a member of OOTC, number 2343, and the Minnesota Wireless Association. During World War II, he was a B-25 flight instructor. That report for the Chapter 8 Upper Midwest Minnesota was filed by Bob Roski and Zero UF Secretary. Our next report, Chapter 91, Vic Clark, Virginia. July was the big meeting for Chapter 91. Vic Culver, W4VIC, from Chapter 119 in Virginia Beach. Let us see all of the planning and work that goes into his chapter's IOTA, that's Islands on the Air, expeditions to Tangier Island. This island, now occupied by several hundred people, sits in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. During the War of 1812, many of the inhabitants were loyalists, and some of the older people still have a trace of the old British accents. July is also the big awards meeting for Chapter 91. This year we awarded 3 50-year, 2 55-year, 3 60, and 1 65-year and 1 70-year. And the biggie, a 75-year award to Bill Levitt, W3AZ. Bill now lives in Maryland, and since it is difficult for him to get to our meetings in Virginia, President Byron Black, W4SSY, and ex-President Tom Donovan, W4CLK, made the trip to present the award in person. They were greeted with a big smile by a man who talks and acts many years younger than you might expect. He received his first license in 1936 at the age of 15 while living on a farm in Nebraska, and still has his very first transmitter. It is built largely from receiver parts and in true breadboard construction. It is built on a chassis from the end of an orange crate. It is dominated by a giant 80-meter coil. It has two tubes, a front panel from a receiver of the time, and does not look like it has enough parts. Bill explained that it was a TNT transmitter, TNT standing for a tuned, not tuned circuit, and did not use a crystal. Incidentally, Bill is pictured with that very, very interesting transmitter on the page that accompanies this submission. Bill occasionally checks into the chapter's 2-meter net and is currently trying to organize an amateur club in the community where he lives. In August, Nick Beauregard, KJ4VTM, presented a program about HACDC. This is an organization from Washington, D.C., made up of mostly young people, many of whom are hams with an interest in technology. Among the things they do are high-altitude balloon launches, building three-dimensional printers, and working with and teaching robotics. It is a unique group in that they have their own shop and classroom in downtown D.C. There are similar organizations in several cities, and I feel sure that most of us in our younger days would have loved to have something like HACDC. September was the annual picnic for Chapter 91. After being promised nice weather all week, Saturday showed up with an off and on drizzle. It was too wet to put the club banner up in a tree and bring out the old crank-up phonograph, but there were plenty of hamburgers, brats, and good conversation. We are sad to report that on July 9, Charles Proctor, KM4CQ, became a silent key. In 2010, Charles received his 55-year award. The Chapter 91 Vic Clark, Virginia, commentary was filed by Byron Black, W4SSY, President. Moving along now to Chapter 112, Yankee, in the state of Rhode Island. Chapter 112 Summer Picnic was held at the New England Wireless and Steam Museum, East Greenwich, Rhode Island, on July 16, 2011. There were 15 members and guests present. Again, the weather was perfect, and the museum was open for everyone to enjoy. Thanks to Tony, W-A-1-E-N-O, and Ann, W-B-1-A-R-U, for bringing vegetables from their garden. We shared their fresh bounty. Our next event will be the CQWA National Convention on September 9-11, 2011, at the Crown Plaza at the Crossings, Warwick, Rhode Island. QCWA National Convention was held at Crown Plaza at the Crossings on September 9-11, 2011. It was a pleasure to have as a speaker at the meet and greet Kay Crakey, N3KN, ARRL President, and at our banquet, FCC's retired Special Counsel Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH. The convention was a great success, thanks to our convention committee and volunteers. Our next meeting will be at the Christmas party on December 3, 2011 at the Chateau Restaurant in Norton, Massachusetts. We thank Janice K4IJK, Secretary, for the filing for Chapter 112 Yankee in Rhode Island. Continuing with the chapter report, Chapter 149, Nutmeg, Connecticut. The summer meeting and luncheon of the Nutmeg Chapter No. 149 was held at the Serafino's Restaurant on August 13, 2011 in Wallingford, Connecticut. Chapter President Mike Schindler, K1AMS, moderated the 40-person gathering. Cliff Kayer, K1IFF, who works for Northeast Utilities, was a guest speaker. He gave a very timely presentation about the electrical grid system and the safety measures one should be aware of if the power lines go down and if one's residence or business loses power. Just 2 weeks after the summer meeting, in August 2011, Hurricane Irene struck the U.S. East Coast and caused plenty of power outages and flooding throughout the East Coast and New England regions, including Connecticut. Cliff's talk incorporated videos and a PowerPoint presentation that helped educate meeting attendees on the dangers posed by the electrical distribution system when it is damaged by storm, proper common sense responses to these emergencies, and what to do if a power line were to fall on one's car or antenna were also discussed. We thank Steve Ewald, WV1X Secretary, for Chapter 149 Nutmeg in Connecticut, for that submission. And one more, Chapter 151, Wild Rose, Canada. QCWA Wild Rose Chapter 151 held its fall luncheon meeting on September 22, 2011 at the Denny's Restaurant on 19th Street Northeast in Calgary. The meeting began with a moment of silence for Silent Keys Bruce Collison, VE6BAC, and Jerry Grief, VE6BN. Chapter President Ken Olke welcomed all members and guests in attendance. Ken talked about the great time he had at the QCWA 2011 convention in Warwick, Rhode Island, and encouraged members to attend next year's QCWA convention to be held in Reno, Nevada, September 24th through 27th, 2012. Elections were held for the chapter executive, who will hold office for the next 2 years. The following people were elected: President Ken Olke, Vice President Terry Finn, Secretary Mitch Goodjohn, and Treasurer Dave Craig. It was noted that the position of Vice President is a newly created position. Dave Watson congratulated Ken Olke on his steadfast contribution to the chapter as president for the past 10 years. Following the meeting, Ken gave a slide presentation on his summer activities, which included attending the QCWA 2011 convention. Ken also showed a video produced by ICOM America in 1991 entitled More Than Radios. It's a heartwarming story about a young boy who develops a close friendship with an elderly ham operator and steadies to get his ham license. The focus was on encouraging people of all ages about the rewards of our hobby. The next meeting of Chapter 151 will be April 2012. The 151 report, Wild Rose Canada, was filed by Mitch Goodjohn, VE6SM. Our thanks to all of those who have submitted reports for the journal. What follows is a very important commentary by Val L. Irwin, W5PUT. Val is a QCWA director. It's titled, Capitol Hill Threatens the 70-Centimeter Ham Ban. Introduction. Each of your officers, board members, and general manager of the QCWA wear many hats to keep our organization running smoothly. In addition to my standard duties as a QCWA board member, I also chair the U.S. side of the External Relations Standing Committee. Skip Swenson, WB6VVA, QCWA director, chairs the Canadian side of the border. What exactly is the External Relations Standing Committee? It simply is a committee within the QCWA's whose job it is to stay aware of what external organizations might be doing that ultimately might have a direct impact on the QCWA, its members, and you as a licensed amateur radio operator. As an example, some of the external organizations that I interface with are the FCC, ARRL, CQ Magazine, Underwriters Laboratories, to name a few. The updated information contained within this document has been presented in part at three venues, the 2011 Dayton Hamvention, the 2011 QCWA Board of Directors meeting, and the associated QCWA convention in Warwick, Rhode Island in September of 2011. Before getting into the issue of the current threat from Capitol Hill, I would like to bring you up to date with another threat to our hobby, broadband over power line, more commonly referred to as simply BPL. Regarding BPL, in recent past years, the hotbed of concern among amateur radio operators has been the deployment of BPL, broadband over power line, hardware, and its RF interference effects upon our ham bands. Now that improvements have been made in BPL technology, most specifically the ability to notch out those band portions of the RF spectrum that might coincide with either amateur or other critical RF communications, the interference reports have drastically decreased. That is not to say that BPL has ceased to be a problem, but we need to continue our vigilance in this area, as some public utility companies still continue to try to deploy some of the earlier interference-causing hardware for purposes of network monitoring. Now, with regard to Capitol Hill threatens 70 centimeters with HR-607, the QCWA External Relations Standing Committee's area of higher concern is now the careful monitoring of the status of the U.S. House of Representatives bill introduced as Broadband for First Responders Act of 2011, or Bill H.R. 607. That House bill was introduced by Representative Peter King, Republican, New York, Chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee on February 10, 2011. What prompted Peter King to introduce this bill? It was done at the urging of the White House, which in turn was brought about by the failure of emergency organizations to be able to fully communicate during times of national emergencies, such as the attack on the World Trade Center Twin Towers disaster in New York City on September 11, 2001, and hurricanes sweeping the Gulf and eastern coastlines during later years. These types of disasters have made emergency/disaster organizations more fully aware that they are not able to fully communicate. The confusion that ensued when the New York City Fire Department was not able to fully communicate with the New York City Police Department during and immediately after the attack on the World Trade Center Twin Towers was massive. Remember that old 50s black and white television show, You Bet Your Life? During that show, the host, Groucho Marx, would always announce a secret word. Now, with regard to future mandated optimum communication, the secret word that you will hear more and more is interoperability, which simply means to be able to reliably communicate between different agencies in times of need and disasters so that aid can be delivered effectively to individuals and communities. Following its introduction to the House of Representatives, H.R. 607 has since been given to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which orchestrates telecommunications legislations. Specifically, H.R. 607 addresses certain spectrum management issues to include the creation/maintenance of a new proposed nationwide public safety broadband network. The bill proposes to distribute the D, for Delta, the D block of the 700 megahertz frequency range for public service use, strangely, on a non-FCC auction basis. The D block consists of 2 5 megahertz wide chunks of spectrum, 758 through 763 and 788 through 793 megahertz, which became available when the FCC ceased authorizing analog TV broadcasts. But in order to recoup the loss of revenue that would have occurred had there been an FCC auction of the D block, the bill proposes to instead auction/reallocate the paired 420 through 440 megahertz and 450 through 470 megahertz bands for commercial use within 10 years of the passage of the bill. Frequencies sound familiar? Thus, as currently written, this bill is a direct attack upon the amateur radio 70-centimeter band. Obviously, the proposed loss of the 420 through 440 megahertz band would be catastrophic to many ham radio operators. It is important to note that even though the 420 through 440 megahertz band is not currently an official public safety frequency spectrum for hams, it is used on a regular basis by hams for public service functions to include coordination of assistance for emergencies such as tornadoes, floods, hurricanes, etc. It is also used extensively for the development of new technologies, slant experimentation, weather spotting, and satellite communications, to name a few. Since the introduction of H.R. 607, I have received several reports that Representative Peter King, Republican New York, Chairman of the House Homeland Security, has been directly approached by the ARRL, ham radio clubs, and ham radio constituents of their concerns about H.R. 607 as it relates to ham radio. To date, even though the rumor is that Representative Peter King has implied that the bill will be edited such that it does not conflict with the ham spectrum, this writer has not detected anything official in that regard coming out of Peter King's office or from the House Energy and Commerce Committee. My attempts to communicate with Representative King have been unsuccessful. While discussing this subject matter at the QCWA members' meeting at Warwick, Rhode Island, President Kay Craigie and 30KN of the ARRL echoed similar problems in communicating with the busy Representative King. Therefore, until we can ensure that H.R. 607 has truly received a rewrite and has ceased to be a threat to ham radio, its approval and endorsement should be carefully scrutinized at arm's length. Now, there has been a Capitol Hill solution presented. On May 19, 2011, Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, co-sponsored by Senator John McCain of Arizona, introduce what is being termed by some as a companion bill to H.R. 607. Personally, I would prefer to use the term a replacement bill. Senator Joseph Lieberman's bill, also called the Broadband for First Responders Act of 2011, has received the Senate designation of S-1040. It amends the Communications Act of 1934 to increase the electromagnetic spectrum allocation for public safety services by 10 megahertz and reduces such allocation for commercial use by the same amount. It directs the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, to 1. Allocate the paired electromagnetic spectrum bands of 758 through 763 megahertz and 788 through 793 megahertz, referred to as D-block, for public safety broadband communications, and license such paired bands to public safety. 2. Establish rules to permit a public safety broadband licensee to authorize public safety service providers to construct and operate a wireless public safety broadband network in the public safety broadband spectrum. 3. Require the wireless public safety broadband network to be fully interoperable, provide for user roaming and priority access to public safety entities, be disaster survivable, have appropriate cybersecurity, and enable authorized users to develop local networks. 4. Authorize the shared use, sub-licensing, or leasing of the public safety broadband spectrum and network infrastructure by entities that are not defined as public safety services. 5. Allow use of the public safety broadband spectrum by emergency response providers. And 6. Establish rules enabling nationwide wireless public safety broadband network interoperability and roaming across any commercial network. Other notable points of this Senate bill are to direct the Secretary of Commerce to 1. Establish a grant program to assist states, municipalities, and Indian tribes to establish a nationwide public service interoperable broadband network in the 700 megahertz band, and 2. Administer a program through which not more than 50% of maintenance and operational expenses associated with the public safety interoperable broadband network may be reimbursed from the maintenance and operation bill. The bill also directs 1. The Assistant Secretary of Commerce to identify at least 15 megahertz of contiguous spectrum between 1675 and 1710 megahertz for reallocation. And 2. The FCC to auction various specified spectrum ranges. 2. Each federal law enforcement agency within 10 years to move all non-commercial network communications to spectrum located in the 700 and 800 megahertz bands. 3. The FCC, with exceptions, from renewing public safety licenses between 170 and 512 megahertz. Now here's a note. Ham radio is not public safety. Now, regarding H.R. 607/S-1040, summary advice. At this point, it is very important to be cognizant of the fact that both H.R. 607 and S-1040 are merely bills which are not yet enforceable law and thus in effect outside the jurisdiction of the Federal Communications Commission. Now, here's a Canadian note. Neither bill has become law in the United States and is thus unenforceable by the Federal Communications Commission. But historically, at such time as it does become law, I anticipate that the Canadian authorities at Industry Canada will follow similarly. The Quarter Century Wireless Association certainly recognizes and supports the need for a dedicated public service spectrum. However, as a member of the QCWA, each of us should oppose H.R. 607 as currently written because it represents a direct threat to the 70-centimeter ham band. Therefore, please join the QCWA in opposing H.R. 607 while supporting S-1040 by writing your House representative. In my travels on behalf of the QCWA, I have been actively encouraging QCWA members to support Senate Bill S-1040 by contacting their senator because the bill is indeed ham-friendly. Since 2012 is an election year for many of the politicians, I don't expect fast action on either of these bills, but we do need to be vigilant at all times. Want to be more knowledgeable and proactive about these bills that can have a direct impact on your ham radio hobby? I encourage each of our members to join the QCWA Reflector, which is managed by our own webmaster and president Bob Roski and Zero UF. For information on how to join the free QCWA Reflector, merely go to www.qcwa.org and then select Info Center. Then scan down the left side until you see Members, and scan to the right and select Reflector, and follow the easy sign-up directions. New information regarding this subject matter will be released to the membership as it becomes available on the QCWA Reflector and in the QCWA Journal, as well as on the QCWA website. Meanwhile, the QCWA will depend on you to be proactive. The commentary was provided by Val L. Irwin, W5PUT, QCWA Director. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to try to finish the rest of this recording with Rules and Regs Digest. This is a very popular part of the printed version of the Quarter Century Wireless Association Journal, every issue. The author is John B. Johnston, called W3BE. John's address is 17701, that's 17701 Bowie Mill Road, B-O-W-I-E, Mill, M-I-L-L, Road, Durwood, Maryland, D-E-R-W-O-O-D, Maryland, M-D, zip code 20855. The submission for this issue is titled, What Must a Ham Know? It's sort of a question and answer commentary. Question, what must a ham know? The answer, this is a decision made by our volunteer examiners, VEs, and volunteer examiner coordinators, VECs. Their conclusion as to what a ham should know in places where the amateur service is regulated by the FCC is that which is maintained in their pools of over 1,600 questions. Included are questions about our regulators' rules, 15%. Our good amateur and good engineering practices, 24%, and those technical fundamentals necessary to making meaningful those rules and practices, 60%. A successful examinee must prove that he or she can answer correctly at least 75% of their questions. It doesn't seem to matter to many administrating VEs, however, which 25% of the questions their examinee has incorrect knowledge. Just exactly what every ham must know absolutely, therefore, is irresolute. Additionally, Section 97.107 authorizes a non-citizen of the United States, quoting, alien, holding an amateur service authorization granted by the alien's government to be the control operator of an amateur station located in places where the amateur service is regulated by the FCC, provided there is, in effect, a reciprocal operating agreement to which the United States and the alien's government are parties for amateur service operation here on a reciprocal basis. So, whatever it is that an amateur operator in some foreign country must know is close enough for a non-U.S. citizen to know here. Question, where exactly in the FCC rules does it say what it is that a person needs to know in order to obtain an amateur operator license? The answer? That is codified in Section 97.501 and Section 97.503. They say that the examinee must pass an examination such as to prove possession of the operational and technical qualifications required to perform properly the duties of an amateur service licensee. Each examination must be comprised of a question set concerning the privileges of the operator license class sought. They are as follows. Element 2, Technician Class Operator. Element 2 and 3, General Class Operator. Elements 2, 3, and 4, Amateur Extra Class Operator. Question. Doesn't the FCC exams cover everything? Answer. They cover what is considered by our VEs to be necessary to be granted an FCC license. Our regulator, however, hasn't prepared or administered our examination since 1983. That is the job of our VEs. Section 97.507B requires that each question set utilize questions taken from our VEC's applicable question pool. Section 97.523 says that all VECs must cooperate in maintaining these pools. There must be at least 1,200 questions distributed among the three pools. Technician, 350, General, 350, and Amateur Extra, 500. The question in the VEC's pools, therefore, establish what it is that a person needs to know in order to be the station licensee or control operator of an amateur station transmitting from any place where the amateur service is regulated by the FCC, with the privileges of the class of operator license grant held. The allocations of the questions in their pools, moreover, indicates what our VEs and VECs deem to be the most suitable privileges for each operator class under any type of conditions. In particular, it is noticeable that they consider technicians and general class operators to be authorized far too many privileges, notably excessive transmitter power limits, unwarranted emission type privileges, and unsuitable special operations privileges. This is evidenced by questions concerning technician class operator and, to a lesser extent, general class operator privileges appearing only in the higher level pools. Question: what types of questions do the pools contain? The answer: our VECs have arranged the questions into 10 sub-elements for each of the three classes of operator license grant. Here is an overall summary. Rules, 14.1%. Procedures, 11.7%. Circuits, equipment, 11.7%. Antennas, feed lines, 11.7%. Electrical components, 10.8%. Practices, 10%. Electrical principles, 9.1%. Modulation, 8.3%. Propagation, 7.5%. Electrical power, RF hazards, 5%. Question. But what does an amateur operator really need to know? Answer. There are at least two very diverse standards for that. Standard 1 comes directly from Section 97.503. It has the objective of expanding our reservoir of trained operators, technicians, and electronic experts. The examinee must prove that he or she possesses the operational and technical qualifications required to perform properly the duties of an amateur service licensee. A person must have those qualifications in order to enjoy a hobby fully and serve the purpose for which it exists, i.e., self-training, intercommunication, and technical investigations carried out by amateurs, that is, duly authorized persons interested in radio techniques solely with a personal aim and without pecuniary interest. Standard 2 comes from the contemporary objective of having as many people as possible with license grants. The examinee needs only be able to give the correct answers to the minimum number of pool questions required to pass. One argument is that it only matters what you do after you get your license, not on how you go about obtaining it. Connie Corner should, apparently, be expected and tolerated. For over 27 years, under agreements with the FCC, our volunteer examiner coordinators have recruited and accredited the tens of thousands of volunteer examiners who prepare and administer our examinations. Our 14 VECs have assembled themselves into the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, for which W3BE has served as vice chairman. The following is from his report of 2011 annual NCVEC conference held on July 29 in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Examinations are to enable RVEs to verify that every licensee is properly qualified for the privileges of an amateur operator license grant in places where the FCC regulates our amateur service. We will presume that everyone here believes strongly that examination is absolutely necessary. As you contemplate that presumption, please be mindful that our VEs make examination opportunities conveniently available practically everywhere. Consider also that our VECs do a splendid job in making known the content of our question pools. As it stands, when a person is even minimally qualified, he or she should have no difficulty in scoring at least our anemic D- passing grade. But we know that not everyone shares our view. This divergence has to be addressed from time to time when we are challenged with arguments against our examinations and schemes to bypass them. They all have that one objective in common: make the exams go away for one group or another who want access to our valuable radio spectrum. You may have read the answers to some of these arguments. Here are some of the most popular that have been received and how they have been answered. Question: we want as many people as possible with FCC licenses. Those burdensome exams frighten away too many potential grantees and are bad for business. The naysayers predicted that doing away with the CW exam would ruin the hobby. That did not happen, just as it also would not happen were those written exams to disappear. Must we really have exams? The answer, yes. Section 97.501 says that each applicant must pass an examination for a new amateur operator license grant and for every change in operator class. Each applicant for each class of operator license grant must pass or otherwise receive examination credit for certain examination elements. The International Telecommunication Union Radio Communication Assembly additionally recommends that administrations take such measures as they judge necessary to verify the operational and technical qualifications of any person wishing to operate an amateur radio license. Question: it is outdated reasoning that examinations are necessary to assure that hams will not construct interference-causing stations, that home brewing era of circuit designs, piece parts, and soldering irons is history. Very few U.S. hams construct or repair their apparatus. They depend almost completely upon foreign-produced apparatus. Those 74% passing grades underscore the futility of the examinations. It means that whichever one-quarter of our licensees' knowledge can be erroneous, the VEs are typically unconcerned about what it is that their examinee has just proven to have a flawed awareness. They seem to stand aloof from the content of your question pool's bank of needed knowledge. Emphasis on the technical aspects of amateur radio is giving way to shoring up operational shortcomings for professional emergency communicators. Technical know-how is irrelevant for them. Can't applicants just sign a statement of knowledge of the FCC rules? Answer: possibly. The precedent is FCC Form 605 and NCVEC Form 605 as well. They both require signing, among other things, this statement: I certify that I have read and will comply with Section 97.13C of the Commission's rules regarding radio frequency radiation safety and the amateur radio section of OSD/OET Bulletin Number 65. Non-U.S. citizens authorized by Section 97.107 are exempt from signing the preceding RF radiation safety statement. The ITU Radio Communication Assembly, however, recommends that any person seeking a license to operate an amateur station should demonstrate theoretical knowledge of international and domestic radio regulations, radio telephony, radio telegraphy, and data and image methods of radio communication, transmitter, receiver, antenna, and propagation and measurements radio system theory, radio emission safety, electromagnetic compatibility, the avoidance and resolution of radio frequency interference. Our examination system, moreover, enables our administering VEs to follow up with each successful examinee at each exam session. They can timely review all questions missed and remedy any misunderstandings that their neophyte may have. Read the rules. Heed the rules. Have a question about the amateur service rules? Visit http://www.w3beinformed.org and email John, that's J-O-H-N, at johnston.net, John at johnston.net. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this brings us to the conclusion of the winter 2011-2012 issue of the QCWA Journal. This recording has been produced in cooperation with the Quarter Century Wireless Association. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham and QCWA members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And the website for the Handy Ham system is www.handyham.org. All your information for QCWA contacts has been given to you in this recording. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call N1BLF. Thanks a lot for listening along with me again.